welcome to the fifth episode of the MisesUK.org podcast, as sponsored by Finlingo.com. My name's Andy Duncan, and tonight, once again, I'm coming to you from Henley-on-Thames, deep in God's own county of Oxfordshire, where today it's been bitterly cold but gloriously sunny. Tonight, I'll be speaking with Sean Gadd, the esteemed chairman of Mises UK, and until 2017, the director of the UK's well-known Libertarian Alliance. As the author of more than 30 books, he's one of Britain's best-known believers in liberty and often appears as a speaker at various conferences around the world. This includes the Property and Freedom event each year in Bodrum in Turkey. He's also a very, very, very close friend of the acclaimed author Richard Blake, and maybe we might speak about that later. Tonight, however, he joins us in his role as Director of the Centre of Ancient Studies, because tonight we'll be discussing a variant of that famous question from Monty Python's Life of Brian: what did the Romans, or the Greeks, ever do for us? And we'll talk about that in terms of modern Western civilization. We'll be covering the major Greek philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle and Epicurus, along with different Roman emperors including Nero, Caligula, and finishing off with Constantine. So without further ado, good evening, Sean.
Good evening, Andy, and thank you for having me on your programme. It's a great honour.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure at this end too. Now, I believe you live in Deal on the Kentish coast, where Charlie Hawtrey used to live. What kind of a day have you been having down there?
Much the same as yours, really. It's been cold, and it's been bitter cold and windy, but it's been gloriously sunny. I was out and about earlier in Ramsgate, which is not exactly the jewel of the Kentish Riviera, but Canterbury has its moments, and I probably had most of them today. And what else have I been doing? Not much else today.
Yeah, Canterbury, the ancient road to Rome. So let's get started then with that Life of Brian question.
Yes.
Besides giving us half of the English language, what do you think the Romans ever did for us?
Can I include the Greeks in that as well?
Yes, of course you can, yeah.
Right. What did the ancients ever do for us? Let's rephrase the question. I think the way into that question is to rephrase it slightly again, mm-hmm. and to say, what didn't the ancients do for us? And I think I'll tell you what they didn't do. What makes our civilization different from any other which has ever existed, and certainly from any other which still exists, is that we are obsessed and have been obsessed for about 400 years now with counting and measuring and general experimentation. We have taken the inductive method and made it into a very fine art as well as a science. Now, the Greeks were not terribly interested in measurement, in counting, or in experiment. And let me give an example of this. Because the ancients didn't have microscopes, they were unable to see the process by which insects and other very small creatures reproduce. They couldn't see the eggs. And Aristotle came up with a very clever, a very inventive explanation for how flies and other small things reproduce. He said they don't reproduce. They emerge through a process of spontaneous generation. The coagulation of dirt and heat and water into living forms. This was, because Aristotle said it, this was taken as gospel, and nobody seriously thought to challenge this, not until, I think it was 1668, an Italian scientist called Francesco Redi. He said, I don't really believe this, and what he did was nothing unusual in our civilization. He took some meat and he left it out in the sun. Some of it he sealed in glass jars, some of it he left exposed, some of it he covered with fine mesh. And at the end of 7 days, what he noticed was that the meat sealed in glass jars was a bit whiffy when you opened it, but no flies had been generated. The meat left in the open was whiffy as well, and there were flies, maggots crawling around in it. And when he looked at the fine mesh, again, the meat that was sealed within this was smelly, but had no maggots, but there were maggots crawling over the outside of the mesh. And that was a pretty definitive disproof of the doctrine of spontaneous generation, it was quite obvious that maggots are generated by the sexual coupling of flies in much the same way as we are generated. This was something that anyone could have done during the previous 2,000 years, but nobody had done. Again, Aristotle said that objects fall at speeds which are proportionate to their weights. And he spent a lot of time explaining why this was the case. It's clear that he had never actually tried it. Epicurus, a philosopher whom I have a lot of time, said, no, objects fall at a uniform speed. But again, he never bothered looking into whether they did this. He just came up with a series of arguments by analogy. It was only when Galileo, the great Italian scientist, I don't think he went up the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but he went into a high place and he dropped two lead weights of different weights, and he noted they hit the ground together. He also set up a series of experiments, nothing complex. We're talking about 17th century technology here, nothing that the Greeks could not have done for themselves. He set up a series of experiments and he showed that objects fall at 8 feet per second per second and continue accelerating. Now, I could go on and on. Now, that sounds like a rejection of the ancients. But, I mean, the question I asked was, what didn't they do for us? When you turn to what they did do for us, the answer would take hours, it would take days, it would take weeks. Indeed, it's taken centuries to explicate exactly what the ancients have done for us and what they continue to do for us. And one of the most important things the ancients did for us was to give us, they articulated a theory of individual rights, which underlies virtually all of classical liberal social and economic and political theorizing. For example, if you turn to Aristotle, if you turn to Cicero, if you turn to Seneca, that there is the notion of a universal moral law, which is the counterpart of the scientific laws of nature. This is a law which is universal to all human beings, not just Greeks, not just Romans, but Egyptians, Syrians, Jews, even barbarians. And local laws or local customs, they are right or wrong, not necessarily according to whether they are simply ancestral customs. They are right or wrong in proportion to how they conform themselves to these universal norms of morality.
So talking about ethics and morals, we have Socrates, who was probably one of the greatest Greek thinkers and writers on ethics, who of course taught Plato and then Plato teaches Aristotle. With Socrates, though, although he was an Athenian citizen, he criticized the Athenian state and praised Sparta in the Peloponnesian War. And he also criticized democracy, which had been invented in Athens about 50, 60 years earlier. Socrates, though, died for these kind of views. He was killed by the Athenian state because of this view against democracy. What do you think of the effect of democracy in the modern world?
Greek democracy and modern democracy share a word, but are broadly different concepts. You know, I won't go into our democracy, which is a question of money and drum majorettes and a corrupted media. Let's look at the idea of Greek democracy. Now, the Greeks had a pretty good understanding of how elites take power and keep power. The idea of democracy in Athens and in a number of other Greek city-states was to make sure those elites never got their hands on power. You do not have democratic elections in the modern sense, because democratic elections appeal to the lowest common denominator and they are decided by money. What the Greeks did, what the Athenians did, was to make sure that every adult free member of the community, every adult male free member of the community, I should say, had an equal chance of taking part in the government of his city. And so you want someone to manage the library. You want someone to manage, you know, one of the libraries. And so you effectively pull names out of a hat. Right, Timon you are the head librarian for the next 6 months. At the end of that period, there is an audit of how you spend the money, but that's about it. Virtually every administrative office in the Athenian state was filled by lot, not by election. That's what they meant by democracy, rule by the people. If you want a general or an admiral, or if you want a skilled diplomat to go and negotiate a treaty, well, you don't leave that to the fortune of the lottery. You do need to have some process of election. But most positions that we would nowadays fill by election or by appointment overseen by elected people, virtually every position was filled by lot. And that meant that money did not talk. It meant that permanent combinations of interest were not allowed completely free play in Athens. Now, that's what the Greeks meant by democracy, and virtually all the faults that we ascribe to the bastardized modern kind of democracy, which I barely need to discuss, were absent from the Greek version. So when you talk about Athenian democracy, it was not many people assume that Athenian democracy meant that all the adult males gathered together in the marketplace and spoke and voted on anything that took their fancy. And sometimes this was the case, but the much more permanent, continuous, everyday meaning of Athenian democracy was that everyone had an equal chance of taking part in the government of his city. Now, what that meant was that the assembly was not just a gathering of yawning, spitting illiterates. It was a gathering of people who all had had administrative experience, and of course, all of whom had taken part in the army or the navy. You had an electoral body which was much better educated in the ways of politics and of government than you could ever hope to find in a modern Western liberal democracy. I'll say for a third time, the critique that is levelled by our people against modern democracy does not actually apply to Greek democracy.
So coming actually from Socrates, we do have Plato, and some have seen him as the kind of font of socialism in the modern age, particularly with his book The Republic, in which he puts forward the idea of the philosopher kings ruling over us in the same way that maybe we might say the EU bureaucrats might rule over us. What do you think of the influence then of Plato on the modern world?
I would say that the influence of Plato has been generally malign. I say that with the confession that I do not honestly understand everything that Plato was getting at. Many of his writings are hard to understand. A further difficulty with Plato is that his ideas appear to have changed over time, and we are not completely certain of what are his early and what are his later writings. And so it's difficult to say with any degree of confidence exactly what Plato thought in general terms. But Plato appears to have been out of sympathy with the democratic spirit of his city. And his idea was to shut down democracy and shut down the general Greek Enlightenment by putting the city under the rule of a set of experts, a meritocracy, a self-appointing meritocracy, which would decide all of the important questions, even down to who gets to have sex with whom. I have trouble understanding why so many people have fallen for this. I can understand why various Greek and Roman elites thought so highly of Plato, because he appeared to justify their own social and political domination once Greek democracy had been cleared aside. And I suppose in the early modern period, the idea that the absolute monarchs of Europe should defer to their tame intellectuals in such matters, I can see why Plato has been so attractive to a certain kind of person, but I don't understand why so many ordinary people have taken this on trust.
So then we come to one of Plato's pupils, which is Aristotle, who's kind of fought against Plato in many ways. Now, you were saying earlier that there's this reverence of Aristotle, and some have also seen him as one of the roots of modern classical liberalism. Why is there this reverence for Aristotle, and do you think that he was a kind of proto-liberal?
I think you could describe Aristotle more as a proto-conservative than a liberal. He was certainly more liberal than Plato. Mm-hmm. Mind you, Aristotle himself was not entirely comfortable with the idea of Athenian democracy. He believed that the elite should be allowed to make most of the important decisions, just not quite so many as Plato had thought. My own belief, Andy, is that if you want to find a Greek precursor of modern classical liberalism and even libertarianism, you do not look to Plato. You certainly do not look to Aristotle. You look instead to Epicurus, who's had an extraordinarily bad press over the millennia because, Epicureanism. Surely what Epicurus believed was in pleasure. Indeed, isn't that what he said himself was the highest purpose of existence, pleasure? Well, that means eating, drinking, having sex, becoming an Epicurean. Unfortunately, most of Epicurus's writings have been lost, or are for the moment lost, until perhaps the pneumatic drills managed to get into the library in Herculaneum. But although most of his writings are lost, we do know enough about his general philosophy to say that he was not an Epicurean in the modern sense. He was a sort of Humean utilitarian. Pleasure is the main purpose of life, but the kind of pleasure he regarded as important was the pleasure of friendship, the pleasure that comes from sobriety, the avoidance of excess, the pleasure that comes from treating people decently. And he denied the entire theological underpinning of the established order of things. He said that a perfectly viable social system can exist not based on force, not based on religious terrors, but on the free association of consenting adults. Once you look into what Epicurus is known to have said and what he probably said, you get something very close to modern classical liberalism.
So in some ways, Epicurus wasn't a hedonist. He was more almost a Misesian person, where Mises would say the point of human action is to reach a place where we have removed the things that we don't like. So that's sort of where Epicurus is getting to. But while the Greek philosophers are talking about various things, they allowed the rise of Macedonia. Aristotle goes and teaches Alexander. The Macedonians rise up. And then later, a couple of hundred years later, the Roman Empire took out Macedonia and took out Greece. Many have seen the British Empire as being analogous to the Athenian Empire. And then they see the Roman Empire as being analogous to the rise of the American Empire coming out of the British Empire. So we get this rise of an enormous military power, then we get the Caesarian monarchy, then we get the bread and circuses welfare, then we get constant warfare, then we get huge corruption, proliferation of laws. And this looks an awful lot like how Western civilization is going. Now, Rome, of course, eventually ends up degenerating into a dark age that lasted 500 years, at least in Western Europe. If history is repeating itself with the Roman Empire, do you think that we could be entering some kind of dark age now in Western Europe?
I sometimes suspect that we are entering a dark age, but mostly I suspect that our runaway science and technology will save us. You know, with a bound, we shall be free. I am dubious about the kind of comparisons that you just made. The problem with the Athenians and with all the other Greek city-states was that they were extreme ethno-nationalists. You could be descended from Corinthians, and Corinth is about, 100 miles from Athens. Your great-great-grandparents could have settled in Athens, having come from Corinth. And at the end of 100 years, you would still not be classed as an Athenian, but as a metic, that is, a resident alien, with extraordinarily limited citizenship rights, indeed no citizenship rights as such. That plus the general tendency of populations in the ancient world to decline meant that the Greek city-states effectively died out. The Macedonians did the Greeks a service by uniting them and also by protecting them from the barbarians, who even in classical times were pressing downwards from the Danube and down from the Black Sea. When the Macedonians ran out of steam, the Romans took over. And yes, the Roman Republic was an astonishingly corrupt and often unpleasant set of structures. And yes, the empire was the rule of one man, quite often a lunatic or an idiot. He was supported by a large and, as the centuries wore on, an increasingly powerful and confident bureaucracy. But, you know, when all is said and done, the Roman Empire at its best, and it was pretty good for quite a long time, the Roman Empire was probably a fine place to be for much of the time. When you compare it with the other civilizations or the other non-civilizations on offer, the Roman Empire was probably the best time and the place to be alive. Even when you had rather freakish emperors in Rome, their ability to interfere in the private lives of ordinary people outside of Rome was extraordinarily limited. Leave aside the existence of slavery, which is the ultimate blemish on their civilization. Leave that aside for the moment. The free citizens were free. You could, you had complete freedom of enterprise, and you had complete freedom of speech and association. That's something which we did not have in the early modern period in Europe. And apart from, to a limited extent, during the 18th and 19th centuries, it's not something that our own particular civilization has excelled in having.
Now, you mentioned there that you think Western civilization might get saved by technology as we head towards maybe what some people call a singularity. Why do you think then that the Greeks and the Romans didn't really develop technology beyond the sword or the wheel or building aqueducts and so on? Why didn't they? I mean, they could and should have invented the steam engine. Why was there this block for them with pushing technology forward?
The natural sciences in our civilization during the past 400 years have advanced mightily on the back of measurement, of counting, and of experiment. And the ancients had a limited understanding of and regard for the value of actual detailed observation. I suppose a further point I could make is that the Greeks appear to have been more technologically advanced than we often give them credit for. We have that Antikythera mechanism, which was found on the seabed 100 years ago, which is a pretty sophisticated planetarium, which can be used to predict all sorts of astronomical events. Its main defect is that it's based on the assumption of the Earth at the center of the universe, which means that it is extremely variable when it comes to predicting the movements of Mars. But for most purposes, it works pretty well, and it works very, very well within the assumptions of Greek astronomy. There were probably all manner of other technological advances of which we know little. We know, for example, that the ancients were able to sail into the wind, something which we didn't rediscover until the 17th century. We believe nowadays that the ancients knew about the distillation of alcohol. So many things which we think were discovered in the Middle Ages or discovered by ourselves during the past 400 years were or may have been discovered by the ancients, but the knowledge was then lost. A third point, I suppose, is to stand beside their disregard for experimentation, which is the availability of cheap slaves. Why bother developing a steam engine? Why bother Why bother applying science to everyday technology when you can get large numbers of apparently cheap human beings to do the work for you? During the 4th century, when a labour shortage emerged, there appears to have been the development of combine harvesting machinery. So they were not complete duffers when it came to technological progress, but they were held back by their philosophical disregard of observation and by the existence of slavery.
I just want to head towards wrapping up now, otherwise we could be here for another 17 hours. Who was your least favourite emperor and why?
You know, that's a hard one because there are so many candidates. If you wanted my list of 10, I could give it to you. But which one do I most dislike?
Well, we could go for your top three bad ones then.
Oh, the top three bad ones. Nero probably was a beast. There are defences of Nero, and there are questions about the veracity of many of the accounts, especially by Tacitus and Suetonius. But Nero does appear to have been a bit of a monster, and it's hard to say anything honest in his defence. Caligula was mad, but really, I suppose I should withdraw the comment I made about lunatics and idiots. Even the emperors who get the worst press among the ancient historians, people like Domitian, when you look at what they did, all right, you know, they murdered various people, but they murdered large numbers of people. But Domitian also banned the castration of slaves in the empire. He improved the status of ordinary people. He cut down on corruption and he ran a fairly tight administration. Tiberius, who gets a very bad press indeed, not least for his swimming pool activities. He appears to have run a pretty tight ship. That may be one reason why he's so unpopular. For the really awful one, Heliogabalus in the 3rd century, that's it. A monster of sexual depravity. The most ardent and licentious sexual liberationist nowadays would take one look at the everyday life of the Emperor Heliogabalus and his jaw would fall open. So, yeah, I suppose you could say that he was about the worst. He was also incompetent as an administrator and he didn't do much to protect the borders either.
Yes, if you want somebody to be evil, you want them to be competent as well. And just thinking in terms of modern classical liberalism or Austrian economics, who do you think was the best emperor? Who should we emulate the most, do you think?
Let me go out on a bit of a limb here, and you know, here is where I start. I think one of the best Roman emperors, and an emperor who often gets rather a bad press, was Constantine. Now, what did Constantine do? He established the Christian faith as the empire's official religion. Now, that meant the establishment of a group of Puritans. It meant that within 70 or 80 years, paganism had been made an illegal religion. And it meant that for the first time, the Roman state took a hand in the systematic persecution of dissenting opinions. However, let me say what I can in favour of Constantine. The Roman state for 250 years before he became emperor had been absolutely supreme. You could live a free life if you were outside of its immediate reach. But if the Roman state decided it didn't like you, it could destroy you. And there was nothing that could stand in its way. You couldn't appeal to any court for judicial review of administrative action. You couldn't take sanctuary in a temple. Once it was decided that you were a bad person, you could be destroyed and no one would stand by your side. What Constantine did was to establish a religion that was not entirely of this world. What it meant was that a bishop could stand on your side, or a priest or a desert monk could say, no, you can't do this, and the authorities would have to back off. For the first time since the collapse of the Roman Republic, you had something like a limited, balanced constitution in the Roman world. You had a duopoly of church and state, and it was possible for many people to play these off against each other. Quite often the state would say, you must do this, and the church would say, you must not do this. And then it was a question of negotiation between the two supreme powers for who got to be, for who got to win that particular contest. Although it's often said that Constantine started a series, he took a series of steps that led to the fall of the Roman Emperor, of the Roman Empire. Actually, Constantine died in 336, 335, I can't exactly remember, I'm afraid. But although the Western provinces fell away 100 years after his death, the Eastern provinces, they remained in pretty good shape for another 300 years until the middle of the 7th century. And when Islam swept through the world, conquering vast swathes of territory, overthrowing ancient empires, although the Muslims took Egypt and Syria, and there were particular reasons for that, and although they took North Africa, and again, there were particular reasons for that, when they tried to take out the core territories of the Eastern Roman Empire, Turkey, Greece, Armenia, and so on, they found they crashed into a wall of armed freeholders led by their priests. And the Eastern Roman Empire, or the Byzantine Empire, as you might want to call it, lasted another 1,000 years. A most remarkable achievement. And a lot of this survival had to do with Constantine's establishment of the Christian faith.
Now, some people have said that the two great surviving remnants of Constantine have been the Orthodox Church in the East and the Roman Catholic Church in the West. And maybe it was the Roman Catholic Church and its competition with the kings of Western Europe that enabled civilization to prosper again in Western Europe. So Constantine maybe is one of the most important emperors that we have. Moving on from Constantine, we do have the rise of the Byzantine Empire. And your very, very, very good friend, Mr. Richard Blake, has written an awful lot about the Byzantine Empire in his series of novels. Have you got any news from Mr. Blake on what he's up to at the moment?
Well, I hope that you and our various listeners will not despise me if I confess that I have slept with Mr. Blake every night for the past 57 years.
Oh, I'd never have thought of that of you, Sean.
We are inseparable companions in every possible sense. What is Mr. Blake up to at the moment? Mr. Blake is resting. It seems that when Sean Gabb is busy, Richard Blake is resting. And when Richard Blake is busy, Sean Gabb disappears. That's probably because each of us offers moral support to the other in whatever he's doing. Mr. Blake has written, I think, 13 novels so far, most of them set in the early years of the Byzantine Empire, the early 7th century. There will be another one later this year, just as soon as Mr. Blake has thought of what to do next. I mean, you are yourself a novelist, and you start out on a series with enormous enthusiasm. You write all the things you want to. And then you think to yourself, well, you know, I'm getting a bit bored with this period and these characters. I'd like to do something else. It's just that Mr. Blake's fans like the Byzantine Empire. And so Mr. Blake is a bit like a fly in amber. He has no choice but to keep churning out those Byzantine novels. And he has to make sure they're good. And so he will write one later in the year. But at the moment, he is having a much deserved rest.
Yeah, he's been typecast, but when Game of Thrones runs out and Hollywood's looking for a new series to produce, maybe Mr. Blake can come to the fore then. Okay, Sean, thank you very much for your time tonight. It's time for me to open a cheeky Rioja, a Faustino Cinco. I'm looking forward to meeting you again and seeing you next week in London at our inaugural conference. Thank you very much for your time tonight.
And thank you for having me on. It was a great pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's programme on the MisesUK.org podcast. To help us out, if you'd like to leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes or even a review, or share our podcast on Facebook or other social media channels, that really will help us to become better known and to spread our message on Austrian economics. Here's one of our latest iTunes reviews written by FriendsUK14855. It's entitled A Quality Libertarian Podcast. they go on to write, it's enjoyable to listen to this UK podcast that promotes libertarian values, as we need them the most. Looking forward to seeing this project growing. Thank you very much indeed. Friends UK 14855. We'll be back soon with the 6th episode of our podcast, where I'll be speaking to Jeff Dice, the president of the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, about the exceptional phenomenon known as Donald Trump. In the meantime, please look after your property and freedom responsibly.